From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The story of Dieter Dengler, a U.S. pilot shot down over Laos during the Vietnam War, was so compelling to director Werner Herzog that he's made two films about him, the 1997 documentary Little Dieter Needs to Fly, and the new film Rescue Dawn, starring Christian Bale. Dengler was captured in Laos and held in a POW camp run by North Vietnamese. He was starved and tortured until escaping into the jungle, only to face more starvation and horror. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Herzog about making Rescue Dawn. Our book critic Maureen Corrigan says she read a terrific debut novel this week by the Korean-American writer Min Jin Lee. Maureen will have a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Gentlemen, welcome to North Vietnam.
That's a scene from the beginning of the new film Rescue Dawn, written and directed by my guest Werner Herzog. It's based on the story of Dieter Dengler, a German-born American pilot who was shot down over Laos in the early days of the Vietnam War. He was captured by Laotian rebels and taken to a small prisoner of war camp run by the North Vietnamese, where he was starved and tortured. Certain that he would die if he stayed, he planned a very risky but successful escape, only to face more starvation and near-death experiences in the jungle as he tried to make his way to Thailand. He was eventually rescued by Americans. Herzog made a documentary about Dieter Dengler in 1997 called Little Dieter Needs to Fly. In Rescue Dawn, Dieter is played by Christian Bale. In this scene, in the POW camp, Dieter is telling his fellow prisoner, Dwayne, about his plan to escape. Dwayne is skeptical and insists that if they do try to escape, they have to wait for the rainy season or they'll die of thirst. Dwayne is played by Steve Zahn.
Without water, you won't survive more than 2 days out there. And without water, your tracks will be visible for even more. The jungle is the prison, don't you get it? Hey, when does the rainy season start?
5 months, maybe six.
I can't wait that long. Hey, listen. Let's say you do survive the jungle and lack water. There's 6 guards posted during the day.
Yeah, that is during the day. I'm going at night.
Werner Herzog is one of the directors who re-established Germany as a force in cinema after World War II. Many of his movies have been about physical and emotional extremes. His films include Aguirre, The Wrath of God, Fitzcarraldo, Nosferatu, and the recent documentary Grizzly Man. Werner Herzog, welcome back to Fresh Air. I want to start with
a confession.
My confession is I love your movies, but I was reluctant to see Rescue Dawn because I didn't want to put myself through sadistic prisoner of war sequences and then an escape sequence through the jungle that would hold its own tortures. But I finally decided, look, it's a Herzog film, so you have to see it. And I think it's an excellent film, but I was wondering, did you experience any of this trepidation when you set out making it? Did you ever ask yourself, do you want to put yourself through a long period of time in which you're immersing yourself in depicting torture and depicting this excruciating escape through the jungle?
Well, it doesn't matter whether I put myself through working on a subject like that. But it's an interesting question because when Dieter Dengler in Little Dieter Needs to Fly, the original person who went through all this ordeal and was the only one who escaped North Vietnamese in Patit Lao captivity, he describes it, and that's okay, you can take it, but and also when you read it in a screenplay, that's fine, it reads all right. The moment you do it in practical terms, I immediately had reservations, and I had a big argument with a production company, and I said, I'm not going to film a couple of these sequences. Finally, I was persuaded, yes, do it, but all these scenes where it's very graphic were all deleted.
Can you tell us, give us an example of something you deleted because of...
For example, yeah. When Dieter is refusing to sign a propaganda letter denouncing the United States, and they hang him upside down and put bamboo sticks, sharp bamboo sticks under his fingernails. I filmed it. It didn't look right because I, as an audience, do not want to see torture in graphic detail. It doesn't feel right. I don't want to see, violence against the defenseless. And this is the reason why I do not want to see, for example, rape of a woman on screen. So it was actually filmed, and most of what is going on was left out. A few things are remaining in there, But when you are dragged, for example, behind a water buffalo on sandy ground, that's okay. I think you can tolerate it, and it's part of Dieter Dengler's story anyway. So I think the film copes with it all right.
You know, Dieter survives this prisoner of war camp and also survives the escape through the jungle. But I'm sure there's more than his survival that interests you about his story. Can you tell us, like, why you wanted to film Dieter's story twice, first as a documentary and then as a feature film? Like, what gets to you in such a strong way about his story?
I think it is quintessentially, it's not a war movie, and it's not so much a prison escape movie. Of course, at the margin it is, but it is more the test and trial of men under inhuman conditions. And this real trial of men was always fascinating for me. And somehow Dieter also embodies everything that I like about America, or about Americans, courage and self-reliance and loyalty and imagination and some sort of frontier spirit. So everything I like about your country is somehow embodied in this one man.
You know, in the documentary story of Dieter, you say in a voiceover toward the beginning of the film that men are often haunted by things that happen to them in life, especially in war or other periods of intensity. Sometimes you see these men walking in the streets or driving in a car. Their lives seem to be normal, but they are not. And I thought, well, that probably really interests you too, the sense of somebody who seems to be normal but really isn't,
right,
because of
yeah.
what he's been through.
Sure, and in Dieter's case, you do not expect from a man who is so jovial, so genial, so optimistic, that under his floorboards in the kitchen, he's stashed away thousands of pounds of rice and flour and honey and things for survival. He says, of course, logically, I know I'll never need it, but yet it feels so much better. I can sleep so much better that I know I don't have to starve ever again.
No, there are scenes where there's a scene where Christian Bale, there's no food. So Christian Bale at one point is eating, it looked like worms to me, but it might have been maggots.
It's maggots. Yeah. It's maggots, yeah.
And then there's another scene in the jungle where Steve Zahn and Christian Bale have leeches on them. Now, the maggots, it looked like Christian Bale was eating real maggots, and it looked like there were
genuine
leeches on their bodies in the
was,
jungle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Why did it have to be real?
Because today you have so many things that are fake digital effects. You have got Photoshop in photos. You never believe, you never trust your own eyes. But when Christian eats maggots, it is so obvious. It is so obvious that you know instinctively as an audience, this is not a joke anymore. He really eats it. Or, for example, when he catches a snake and the snake tries to strike at him, and he nimbly eludes it. And so these things are leeches on your body, which is not a bad thing anyway, but it looks bad, and the actors were for it and they accepted it. And I think the audiences are put in a situation, in a position which is very fundamental. We can trust our eyes again, and that's what I like about the film.
What did you tell the actors when you were casting them about what they would have to do, what they'd have to endure in the making of Rescue Dawn?
Well, I told them I would take them where they hadn't been before in their career. Christian Bale, I asked half seriously, half jokingly, would you be ready to bite a snake in half? And he said yes, and that was that. He actually didn't have to bite a snake in half, but he was prepared for everything. But always knowing that I, as a director, would automatically offer to demonstrate things, that they were not dangerous, that they were okay. When it came to maggot eating, I said to Christian, just wait a moment, I take a few spoonfuls. And he said, no, just let me do it alone. Just turn on the cameras and let's get over with it. So, but normally I would be with them. I would offer to do difficult things to demonstrate. And they always felt safe.
Was there a doctor on the set?
There was, but we never had any emergencies. I'm a very professional man, very circumspect when it comes to risks. But you see, eating maggots is not a risk.
It's not. I've never eaten them.
I couldn't say for sure. they're actually very rich in protein.
Now, your actors also lost a lot of weight. I mean, they really look like they had been held as prisoners of war for a long time. They were emaciated. They were just like skin and bones. I understand, you said before that you had offered to do things along with them. I understand you lost a lot of weight with them, not quite as much.
Let's face it, in solidarity, I lost about half the amount of weight that Christian Bale lost.
Mm-hmm. And I also understand you shot the scenes in reverse, the emaciated scenes, the most emaciated scenes first.
Yes, you have to do it.
Why do you have to do it that way?
Because losing weight, you do that very slowly and professionally and under supervision. It takes about 5, let's say 6 months, and you lose, I don't know, 50, maybe 60 pounds. And gaining it back goes pretty fast. You eat a lot, and in 3-4 weeks, you are back at your normal weight. So what we had to do, we had to shoot the film backwards in huge chunks. The actors are bearded, and they are very thin, very emaciated. After the first large chunk of shooting, which was end of the movie, he started to eat. And within 3 weeks or 4 weeks, he was back to his normal weight. And the very first images in the film is stuff that we shot at the very end of shooting. So a real, real challenge for an actor to develop a character backwards.
Yeah.
A real challenge for continuity, to establish a continuity backwards. A real challenge for a director to establish a flow of narration and a rhythm and, of course, a build-up of a character as well.
During the Escape Through the Jungle sequences, Steve Zahn and Christian Bale's characters are both completely emaciated, but Steve Zahn more so because he's been a prisoner of war considerably longer than Christian Bale's character. And he's so weak at that point. He has to constantly lean against Christian Bale. And there's a couple of scenes within this portion of the movie in which Steve Zahn's eyes just seem to say pain and death. And I don't know that I've ever seen eyes look quite like that in a movie. And I'd really like to hear about creating those sequences and just those close-ups of his face.
Right. You're pointing out at something which can be described very simple. I had the privilege to work with the best of their generation, and Steve Zahn is such an extraordinary actor of such great abilities. The wonderful thing was that it was not a Hollywood film I made. It was made outside all of these systems. I think a Hollywood studio would never have agreed to cast Steve Zahn, who is more known to the general audiences as the funny sidekick in Eddie Murphy movies.
Exactly.
And but some early films of Steve Zahn point into a direction where I really went very, very deep. And so I think it's a huge, huge achievement of a phenomenal talent.
My guest is film director Werner Herzog. We'll talk more about making Rescue Dawn after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Werner Herzog, and we're talking about making his new movie, Rescue Dawn, which is about an American pilot, a German-born American pilot who's shot down early in the war in Vietnam and is taken prisoner of war and eventually escapes through the jungle. In an early scene in the movie, we see overhead footage, a footage shot from an airplane, of bombs being dropped on what I assume is Vietnam. And we see, you know, we see the explosions and huts starting to burn as they catch fire from the explosions. And it's all shown in slow motion. Now, the same footage is in both Little Dieter Learns to Fly, your documentary about Dieter Dengler, and in Rescue Dawn, your feature film about Dieter Dengler. Where did you find this footage, and how did you choose it, and also why did you want to use it in slow motion?
I think it is not even slow motion. It appears as if it were slow motion, but
really?
It was footage recently released by, or something like 10, 15 years released, and it's available in the National Archive in Washington, and it was footage which was used for bomb damage assessment. And you see, it has this horrifying beauty about it, and the music that is playing there, composed by Klaus Bartelt, who did it very wonderfully. It's an almost serene, almost idyllic music accompanying it. It's a little bit like Kubrick's atomic explosions at the end of Dr. Strangelove. But of course, this footage, with that footage, basically war footage, and it's the first minute in the film, ends, because in a way it is correct, in a way it's misleading or inventive, because the war lasted exactly 40 minutes for Dieter Dengler. In his first mission, he was shot down. So, of course, the film emphasizes other things that are not directly Dieter Dengler's story. This kind of bombing raid was never anything Dieter Dengler did. And, of course, we had to reinvent or modify his character according to Christian Bale. We were not slavishly following exactly all idiosyncrasies of Dieter Dengler.
You've made several movies set in the jungle. Aguirre and Fitzcarraldo were set in the Amazon jungle. The documentary about Dieter has jungle sequences in it, and of course the new film Rescue Dawn is set in the jungle. What characteristics of the jungle did you most want to capture in Rescue Dawn? Because the jungle is another character in the movie. The jungle is alive.
Right, yeah. Yes, it's never a backdrop for a story. Like, for example, commercials would find the most scenic backdrop. But for me, a landscape is always a living character in the movie. And it has somehow qualities that normally define a human being. It's like the fever dreams in us, and how to depict that. I shoot the jungle in a very specific way, and landscapes have always been very, very important. And of course, I've done 4, 5, 6 films in the jungle, but I've made almost 60 movies so far. And my last film, which I finished just yesterday, is a film I shot in Antarctica.
Oh.
And of course there it's an incredible vastness of landscape and a solitude beyond description, and just as if Antarctica was one of the leading characters in the film.
No one would accuse you of not being interested in extremes.
No, Antarctica isn't that extreme. It's actually, today it's quite easy, or fairly easy. We are always thinking back to the days of Shackleton and Scott and Amundsen. Of course, every step was a big toil, and it was a dangerous thing. Today, Antarctica is easy.
In one of the scenes when they're in the prisoner of war camp, Dieter really wants to escape, and one of the characters who's very skeptical about trying to escape says to him, "The jungle's the prison, don't you get it?"
Yes.
When you were filming in the jungle, was the jungle ever prison-like for you? Could you do the things you needed to do as a filmmaker and as a person?
That's a difficult question. Yes, sometimes when you are caught in the middle of shooting, next town is 1,400 kilometers away. I mean, a place where you could buy a battery for a torchlight, or make a phone call, and you've got a small town built for 1,100 native Indian extras, and the rivers become unnavigable because you've got islands of trees floating by every 20 feet or so, another tree is floating by, so you can't use a boat. And all of a sudden, you are a prisoner in the jungle, and you've got 1,100 disgruntled men and women with you who haven't seen a chicken for dinner for a week or so. So then it becomes rough, and you have to pull a ship over a mountain, and it doesn't move. So, but at the same time, I like the jungle. I love it. Sometimes, and I said I love it against my better judgment, but we should not forget that the jungle is just another forest, and it has great beauty. It has great mystery. It's just got everything.
Werner Herzog will be back in the second half of the show. His new film is called Rescue Dawn. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Classics edition of The Federalist, papers by Hamilton, Madison, and Jay, in stores and online at bn.com. And from Fox Searchlight, presenting Once, the tale of two kindred spirits making music and finding romance on the bustling streets of Dublin, now playing in select theaters. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk with director Werner Herzog about when he was taken prisoner while making a movie in Cameroon. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews the debut novel Free Food for Millionaires, which she describes as a Korean-American riff on 19th century novels like Jane Eyre and Pride and Prejudice. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with filmmaker Werner Herzog. His new film, Rescue Dawn, is based on the story of Dieter Dengler, a German-born American pilot who was shot down over Laos in the early days of the Vietnam War. His ambition wasn't to fight in war, he just wanted to fly, and joining the military was the easiest way for him to do that. While Herzog was trying to raise the money he needed to make Rescue Dawn, he made a documentary called Little Dieter Needs to Fly. Here's a scene from the 1997 documentary in which Dieter Dengler is in Bavaria in the neighborhood where he grew up. He's reminiscing about his childhood during World War II.
The first airplanes that I ever saw in my life, they came right over here. They were fighters. They dove down to this small town. They made senseless attacks on just small villages like this. And behind me, up there, that's kind of how it looked. I had two brothers then. We were on the top window, and we looked out. And we watched all this. Now, clearly remember, one of the airplanes came diving at our house. And it was so unusual, because the cockpit was open. The pilot had black goggles that were sitting on his forehead. He was looking. He had actually turned around. He was looking in at the window, and the machine guns were just firing, because the flashes, I keep seeing them coming out. And the left wingtip just missed the house by 2 or 3 feet as it ripped by. It was just a fraction of the second. It was like a vision for me. It was like an almighty being that came out. It was just something else. It's very difficult to describe. But I knew from that moment on that I want to be a pilot. I want to be a flyer. From that moment on, little Dieter needed to fly.
Here's the same story as told by Christian Bale, who plays Dieter Dengler in Werner Herzog's new film Rescue Dawn. Dieter is talking with his fellow prisoners in the North Vietnamese POW camp, and one of them asks him this question.
How'd you ever end up a pilot?
I was with my brother. We were looking out, and we see this fighter plane, beautiful, coming right at us. And it's firing from his wings, and I see the machine gun flashing, and goes flying past the house. He's looking right at me. And as he turns, he's turning back. He's looking right at me still. And the thing is, from that moment on, little Dieter, he needed to fly.
Dieter Dengler died in 2001 before Rescue Dawn was made. Let's get back to our interview with Werner Herzog about shooting Rescue Dawn in the jungle. Let me just ask you about one other really visually striking and very kind of creepy image, surreal image in the movie. And this is from early on, like, you know, Dieter's been taken hostage and taken prisoner of war, and he's tied down. This is before he arrives at the final POW camp. He's tied down, and at his head is a little child with a very large bug on a string. And the child is kind of, you know, bouncing this bug on a string in front of Christian Bale's face, and by his feet sits an adult with this really large butterfly. And it's such a surreal image. Does that come from something that Dieter had described to you, or is that an image that you thought of?
No, neither did Dieter describe it, nor did I think about it, but when I started working in this village of hill tribe people, Karen people, I all of a sudden ran into some children who had these gigantic rhino beetles on a string, and they buzz around, and they sound like a wooden helicopter. And I liked it so much that I introduced it into the film, and Christian Bale, or Dieter, who is tied to the ground, spread-eagled, is woken up by this strange sound of a wooden helicopter, and it turns out it's the strangest of rhino beetles whirring around on a string. And then, by coincidence, that same day, I find a huge butterfly, some sort of a night butterfly, gigantic, I mean, larger, much larger than two palms of hands. And I gave it to this prison guard, and I said to him, be very gentle with the butterfly so it won't escape. And we filmed it. It's just fascinations of things that I stumble across.
Now, during the making of one of your early documentaries, Fata Morgana, you were apparently taken prisoner in Cameroon, where you were shooting. Apparently one of your cameramen had the same name as a fugitive soldier of fortune, and they thought you were both mercenaries. Do I have the story right?
We can only guess, but it was probably that we were mistaken for mercenaries, and the name was quite too close. So yes, that happens. We were just taken prisoner, but it wasn't that bad. I mean, it was fairly bad, but could have been much worse. The real bad side of the story is that both the cinematographer and I had malaria and another much more serious tropical disease. So we were quite weakened, and that's okay. You go through things like that.
Did being held prisoner and being sick while you were a prisoner make you any more interested in shooting a movie like Rescue Dawn about being held prisoner in the jungle?
Not necessarily, but I do understand the situation fairly well. So, yes, of course, and of course, it's other things as well. As a child, like little Dieter or Dieter Dengler, we were both very hungry. We grew up in a time, in Dieter's case, much worse. His mother took the boys out into bombed out villages, and they would rip wallpaper from walls, and the mother would cook it because there were nutrients in the glue. So you can imagine how hungry the children were at that time. It wasn't that bad for me, but I do understand a situation like that. I do understand the situation of what it means to be imprisoned. I was actually never really imprisoned for a long time. I was held captive and then released and then recaptured. So it was kind of unpleasant, but it was still manageable.
You're very willing to enter the territory of pathology and pain in your movies, but I'm wondering if there's ever a time when you just experienced like the pure terror of the nightmarish kind of sequences that you sometimes shoot.
Well, I'm, so to speak, clinically sane, and I have my natural defenses of not being terrorized. But when you speak about pain and pathology, I would be careful to accept it, because I'm much more in general into the human condition. I want to look, of course, into the abysses of the human soul, but I'm also looking into the joys and exhilarations of the human heart. And so I'm not into anything masochistic or into pain and all that. It occurs sometimes in movies where human beings are under great stress and under unusual conditions, sometimes even inhuman conditions. But it's always with looking at us as human beings, with all the grandiose sides that we have as well, great projects in our imagination, great exhilaration, great wonderful things that we are out to explore.
That often end up in pain and extremes. Well. I know you keep denying it, but... My guest is Werner Herzog. His new film is Rescue Dawn. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Werner Herzog, and we've been talking about his new movie, Rescue Dawn. I would like to ask you a question or two about an earlier documentary you made that was released about 2 years ago called Grizzly Man, which is an extraordinary film about somebody who saw himself as a naturalist who was going to save the grizzly bear, but really he wasn't. He was more intruding on their territory than helping them. And your movie is made in part from the films he made of himself while he was in the wild with the grizzly bears. And it's an amazing film. And you'll think that this is crazy, so I'll say it anyways. But it kind of reminded me of like an in-the-wild version of Taxi Driver in the sense that it's about somebody who looks around him and thinks that everybody... He's totally alienated from people. He thinks everybody's crazy and he's the sane one. And he's not.
Terry, I think you shouldn't watch that many movies. But anyway, yes. No, it's an extraordinary film because Timothy Treadwell and his footage are so extraordinary. It is actually... I keep saying if you want to look as deep as it gets into the abyss of the human soul, just watch Grizzly Man, watch Treadwell, because it's not only his moments where he's misled and misguided and has this kind of vanilla ice cream, new age pseudo philosophy. He also made a lot of sense. He also had moments of dejection and despair and exhilarated moments. So a very, very complicated, multifaceted human being. And looking at him and working with his footage was just a very, very rewarding thing. So we can thank God on our knees that Treadwell did all this footage. And I think it was also a blessing that the two of us found each other in a way, even though Treadwell was already 10 months dead. He was eaten by one of the bears together with his girlfriend and died very tragically. And it was a good thing that in a way we found each other. And those who know both Treadwell and me keep maintaining we would have liked each other even though we were so different.
There's a scene in the movie, and this is a very kind of famous scene from the film, in which you listen back to a tape that was recording as Treadwell and his girlfriend were eaten alive by a bear. And we don't hear it. We the audience doesn't hear it, but you've heard it. And I guess I've wondered about what impact that had on you as a film director, because, you know, you've directed fiction films as well as documentaries. So mm-hmm. you've directed people in death scenes. And in the kinds of scenes that you can only imagine. But you mm-hmm. heard what it was like, the real thing of what it was like to be eaten alive by a bear.
And it was the most terrifying I've ever heard in my life. But I, in a way, I had to address it because production company and network that broadcasted Discovery and Lionsgate, the theatrical distributor, asked me to address this tape because it was known in public. It was known in articles and other reports that there was a tape in existence. So I said, I'm going to address it, fine, but I have to hear it and then I will make a decision. And the moment I heard it, and it's not me so interesting to hear it, it's more the face of Jewel Palovac, the woman who founded Grizzly People together with Treadwell, knew him for 20 years, lived with him for some of that time, trying to read from my face what I'm hearing and how I'm reacting. And it's a very, very intense moment. And the moment I heard it, I knew only over my dead body, this is going to be published in a film that I do. And it's a similar thing like in Rescue Dawn. There are scenes of torture that are not in the film, period. Only over my dead body, they would be in it.
But getting back to actually having heard the tape, did that have an impact on you as a film director in terms of what you think death sounds like and what you want to hear when you're directing a death scene?
No, when you hear a tape like this, you are not a film director anymore, and you are not a German or an American or a Japanese or anyone anymore. You're just a stark, naked human being that is confronted with the most terrifying a human being can be confronted. Nobody deserves to die like him. No one. No matter whether he made mistakes or not. And you are not a film director anymore when you hear a thing like that.
Okay, well, that's just the thing. A lot of people are afraid to expose themselves to certain images or certain sounds because they're afraid that they'll never be able to turn it off, that sound, that image is going to come back to haunt them. And what about you? Were you able to hear the most horrible thing and then
yes, sure,
put it aside, you know, and forget?
You do not. Now you can't put it aside, but you have to deal with it and you have to have a healthy response to it and live on healthily anyway. But it's, in a way, it is an attitude that I always had. My friends are wondering, why did I watch Ann Nicole Smith show? Why do I watch WrestleMania? My answer is...
Yes?
No, seriously, I do that. My answer is the poet must not avert his eyes from what's going on in the world. In order to understand what's going on, you have to face it.
Now, you said a poet should never avert his eyes. But the last time we spoke on Fresh Air, you told me the one thing you'd never looked at was your own eyes, that you didn't know the color of your eyes, because when you look in the mirror, you don't really want to study your face. However, you are now acting in a couple of films, and you were saying to me before the interview.
That's something different.
So, but you've seen your face on a big screen now, right? Well, and you must have seen yourself in documentaries that you're in, too.
My voice, and sometimes I appear. Well, when I say I don't like to look into my own eyes, it's this kind of aversion against psychology and against shrinks and illuminating every last corner.
Right, too much introspection. Yeah,
I don't like that. But of course, not only do I release Rescue Dawn right now, and I have a new film which I made in Antarctica. I have two more films for release right now, where I'm, as I call it, a paid stooge. Actually, I'm acting. Now, I love everything that has to do with cinema, acting, directing, writing, editing, production of movies, everything. So I love to act in movies, and I'm not bad at all if it comes to dysfunctional, vile, and base and terrifying characters. I'm good at that. Even though, as a private person, and my wife will certainly confirm that, I'm a fluffy man. but in some of the films, like Harmony Korine's Mr. Lonely, I'm playing a fanatical missionary priest, and in Zach Penn's The Grand, which is about a poker tournament, I'm playing the German who keeps strangling rabbits just to feel, in order to feel alive. So I'm not a very pleasant character on screen, but I'm good at that.
One last question. You know that it's I think it was a Baudelaire, I can't remember who's, Flaubert, who said, and I'm going to paraphrase this in a way that'll probably kill the quote, but it was something like, one should live one's life with a lot of moderation and save the extremes for the art. I've killed the quote, but that's basically what it says. Do you agree with that?
No, because there is no distinction between life and art or work. I'm just slaloming wildly through life and through films, and I may leave a few fleeting traces in the sand that will be wiped out very soon. So now it's all, I take it all, and I spend it all, and I invest it all, and I'm just doing it the way I feel right. I feel that's how my life is taking place.
Werner Herzog, it's great to talk with you again. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Werner Herzog wrote and directed the new film Rescue Dawn. Coming up, our book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews a debut novel she thinks is terrific by the Korean-American writer Min Jin Lee. This is Fresh Air. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says that reading Min Jin Lee's new novel, Free Food for Millionaires, is almost as much fun as eating a handful of Bertie Bott's Every Flavor Beans with a bunch of strangers at midnight.
It's been a good summer for those of us who worry about the future of books. Last Friday night, I waited for hours at our local independent bookstore for cartons containing the last Harry Potter novel to be ripped open at midnight. My daughter and two of her friends, all 9 years old, were in costume as Fluffy the three-headed dog from the first Potter book. They'd cut three head holes into a big cardboard box and were sweating in this getup amidst a horde of kids and adults dressed as witches, magic mirrors, muggles, and of course Harry himself. Sure, I'd read the arguments that Pottermania is just well-orchestrated publicity, that the series isn't as good, literally speaking, as, say, The Iliad or Beowulf, and that Rowling's books can't single-handedly lure kids away from the dark forces of video games. But at the stroke of midnight, those objections vanished. The crowd surged forward, whooping. Customers clutched their fresh copies of Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, and the line moved out of the store into the parking lot, where magic was happening. Amidst the hullabaloo, kids were standing still in that lighted parking lot after midnight, lost in reading the first chapter. I'm going to treasure that vision of the parking lot as a talisman against despair over the fate of books and reading. And then another cheering development. I read a terrific debut novel this week. It's always heartening to find a good new writer, but what's especially delightful about Min Jin Lee and her new novel, called Free Food for Millionaires, is that she's taken up the expansive form of the 19th century novel and its concerns about money, marriage, and duty to create a kind of Korean-American riff on all those sagas, Pride and Prejudice, Jane Eyre, Middlemarch, where the principled heroine sometimes behaves like a downright fool. Lee's heroine, Casey Han, has just graduated from Princeton, and as the daughter of Korean immigrants who operate a dry cleaning shop, she's mired in student loan debt. In the opening pages, Casey and her father get into an argument. He hits her and banishes her from their cramped apartment in Queens. When she flees to her boyfriend's apartment in Manhattan, she discovers him romping on the floor of his bedroom with two sorority girls he's just picked up at a bar. How would George Eliot's Dorothea Brooke handle this situation? Casey copes by hailing a cab to the ritzy Carlisle Hotel and maxing out her brand new credit card. A smart insight that Lee elaborates throughout Free Food for Millionaires is that, whereas in most Victorian novels, where a character who climbs up the class ladder will hang on for dear life to whatever rung he or she has attained, 21st century Americans can sometimes sample disparate class experiences in the course of a single day. A first-generation striver like Casey, who eventually lands a low-level job on Wall Street, can start the morning by scrambling to find car fare for the subway and end the evening by eating a business dinner at a chic restaurant where coffee costs $10 a cup. Such class tourism, however, carries a psychic cost. Casey sometimes feels as if other people around her were members of some improved world, where every pot had a lid. Of course, the compact geography of Manhattan encourages such excursions into other worlds, and Free Food for Millionaires is reminiscent of another ambitious New York novel about class collision, Tom Wolfe's Bonfire of the Vanities. Unlike Wolfe's cynical, omniscient narrator, however, Lee's narrator seems generously amused by her character's flaws. The pleasure of reading this sprawling novel derives from the old-fashioned thrill of watching the wheel of fortune slowly turn for various characters. The virginal bride contracts herpes, the good catch turns out to have a gambling problem, the self-satisfied Korean-American prig loses all for a tumble in bed with a hot Irish redhead. In the Victorian-inflected saga of Casey Han and her friends, Lee has given readers more than just Elizabeth Bennet tricked out in a Korean hanbok. She's tweaked venerable 19th-century fictional forms to suit the story of yet another new immigrant group claiming New York City as its own. Like J.K. Rowling, Lee evokes the stories of centuries past to imagine a space where the individual consciousness of a single reader can still merge with the sensibilities of a single writer's humble artifact, the novel.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Free Food for Millionaires by Min Jin Lee. You can download podcasts of our show by going to our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Minhivar. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Delacorte Press, publisher of How to Talk to a Widower, a novel by Jonathan Tropper about coping with death, fatherhood, and learning to love again. From the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation, supporting educational, cultural, and environmental initiatives to make our world more livable. On the web at grdodge.org. And from creditcards.com, an online destination for consumers to search, compare, and apply for credit cards, on the web at creditcards.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the actress who does the voice of Bart Simpson. We talk with Nancy Cartwright about what it takes to sound like a 10-year-old boy. The Simpsons movie opens this week. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.